We continue with the client-server discussion we had, and we basically look now at or continue to look at the alternatives or example environments or example client-server environments. The yesterday we talked about the file service, and there especially the distinction between stateless and stateful. Stateless, where the server does not really capture or keep any state information of the client. Basically, every request is self-contained, and therefore also the client environment has to take care of the consistency of the cache, if the cache content is correct or not, and the stateful server, where basically the file server keeps some state about client requests, and especially if you think of sessions where a client has multiple requests, for example, concerning the same file, and then in that case the server would keep some information about the client, and additionally also the server basically keeps track of the cache information on the client side. And the next example we can look at is time service. That's all usually what every local environment has, something like a time service, and it's usually running on the machine which has somewhat a stable clock, and usually you don't really have a separate machine as a time service. It's basically running on a machine which is defined by the computer administration, and what they provide is something like a synchronized system-wide time for all nodes, and either the time service has contact to other time services where it synchronizes its time. Therefore, what you usually find with time services is something like primary time service, or the primary level, secondary level, or tertiary level, in that sense that you have something like a hierarchy of time services. And on the top level, the time services usually try to synchronize with the atomic clock. For example, here in Germany with the atomic clock in Braunschweig. And all the other services, clients as well as servers, contact the time service just to synchronize again. And later on we will see some approaches like the network time service, how that works to synchronize the time. The next thing we can look at it is the name service. And the goal here is to map names towards addresses. And the names can refer to objects in a sense of files, but they can also be servers, services, PCs, printers, but they can also be the name of users. And usually they it provides something like a centralized name management facility, and clients can basically access that information. If, for example, we have only these two components of an entry, then very often we call them directory service, and instead of name service. And therefore, in that sense, you basically have only a mapping between name and address. You could also have, and the address depends. It could be, for example, just the host number and the port, which may be used to contact the service or the object, the entity. Additionally, we might have some added information, like access information, for example, to limit the access, for example, that certain clients may be allowed and certain clients may be not allowed to access the entity, or other attributes, for example, like cost. What does it cost? Or the access bandwidth. And that's especially important, for example, if for certain services you have multiple options, then the client can decide, for example, with that you have a trade-off between bandwidth and cost, that the client says, well, it's completely sufficient with respect to a lower bandwidth, but if the cost is lower. And therefore, in that sense, the client can decide which service might be more appropriate for it. The other thing is the term name service. If you look at the object-oriented environments, very often you have something like what they call object server. And that provides information about object name to object ID. And it could be that, or the object address, I wouldn't call it object ID, let's call it object address. And for example, we have the identifier of the object, which is unique. And if you have an object which migrates between different environments, then the address provides you information where you actually find currently the object. And that's you can use the object server, which provides you current information for finding and accessing the object. A very early name service was the Sun Yellow server, which basically maintained the name of users together with password and other user profile information. And in that case, Yellow Page server. Therefore, in that sense, it provided information for logging in. And the Sun environment was a distributed environment. And also the Yellow Pages were often distributed across multiple machines. And that provided information when you tried to log in, the host where you tried to log in contacted the Yellow Page server, find out is that person allowed to log in or not. And that was an early way of an early example of a name server. And the goal of this name servers is to provide location transparent access. Also here, location transparent access. And we can look at examples. One example we will talk a little bit in more detail. One example, what you find in the environment here is DNS, Domain Name Service, and here it provides or the support for a naming scheme in the internet, that you don't need the IP address. You basically have the name, and then you can map it from host names to the IP address. The same thing with respect to email destinations, to map it to the IP address. The top level things, Edo and so on, you have a whole bunch of possibilities. You know, it's basically now somewhat open that you don't have these restricted domain names anymore. There are a whole bunch of domain names which were introduced in the last few years. And the important thing is that DNS is not a centralized system or server. It's basically distributed and across the network. On the one hand, you have these root domain or root DNS servers, and then you have these local DNS servers. And if you look at this animation, you have two types of ways of interacting with the DNS. For example, if you want to have if you are here and you want to have something like an iterative approach, it would more or less look like this. You contact your local one. This one doesn't know it. It contacts some other DNS. This one, and it gets the information back. Therefore, you always have the interaction that slowly and gradually you come closer to the target domain name server. And if you do it recursively, the way it goes, it's basically you contact your local one, go to the next one, which basically you just go back on your name, then you find the root one, then you basically go from the back as far as you then go iteratively, and then the answer, I mean, this one is now in German, but basically you see the difference between iterative and recursive, that in one iterative you basically interact always constantly with the various DNS, and this one, the starting DNS, the local PC contacted, interacts with the various DNS servers. In the recursive one, basically the request goes slowly through all the hierarchy of DNS servers. And on the top level, you have these root servers, which have information about these other strategic domain name servers. And strategic, it's more or less, if you look at the name, you go and a structure of the name here, like here, and you would have like .de. Therefore, in that sense, you go from in that direction to look for the appropriate DNS servers. The other example, what I wanted to mention is LDAP. And LDAP is pretty far available. And it's pretty much a standard which is usually supported implicitly by the browsers, that they also already include information how they can interact with an LDAP server. Therefore, you don't need any plugins or anything else. Basically, all the browsers support natively the an LDAP server. And LDAP, you can say, is basically a protocol to access and update directory information. It's used here at the university. therefore every student or every researcher or every person from personnel basically has an entry in the LDAP server. We don't have just one LDAP server at the university, we have multiple ones, and the separation, I'm not really certain if every department has one, but I know it's a number of different LDAP servers which are available here at the university. It's used by Moodle, it's used by TUM Online, it's used by the various other systems, and if you register with the Immatrikulationamt and also with personnel, with personnel department, they basically create an LDAP entry to register you as a person in the LDAP server. We can quickly look at some of the basics, and if we think of things like what is a directory and what is a database? What's the difference? Because you could say, well, what for do I need something like a directory service? Why don't I use just a regular database and then just use SQL statements to interact or modify entries? And if you look what directories are used for, it's basically a list of objects with descriptive information. And the difference you can say with a directory, you have a high volume of read requests. And we can even say very few write requests. It's the read requests dominate, and therefore the read requests are in a way arranged that they can provide a high performance. Write, you can have a lot less emphasis on write operations with respect to performance. The other thing is directories have no support of transactions, and also the query language is different because of the focus also on the read requests. Here, query on databases, I mentioned it, it's basically SQL, what you use even if you use an object-oriented database, they have a variation which they have something like an object-oriented QL, query language, which somewhat orients itself on the SQL. The point is here that a directory service, it's basically a name service, which just does the mapping between name and address, and it also includes meta information. And the meta information, that's these additional attributes. Like for a person, it's profile information. For printers, it might be the speed of the printing speed or other information, if it's a laser printer, an inkjet color or black and white and things like that. And that's the additional information which you can put in as into the directory. You have the same thing compared with or in similar to telephone books. You have these white pages and yellow pages. White pages, you access the object with respect to the name, and you go and search using the name. Or you can have yellow pages where you have meta information in it. And that's the same thing as yellow pages on a telephone book. den German gelbe Seiten, where it's basically you search for certain characteristics. In, if you look for a plumber or if you look for a restaurant. And the same way you could use here like meta information, print up black and white and use that to search for alternatives with respect to directory entries. And the important aspect is that LDAP, it's basically a communication protocol, and it defines the transport and the format of messages, and therefore LDAP. We talk about LDAP server. That's a server which supports the LDAP protocol, but the LDAP itself is not really the server. Therefore, the LDAP is the communication protocol, which is then supported by the LDAP server. And it does not define itself the directory. Also here, we can say, also here, LDAP does not define directory itself. And that actually means you can have multiple implementations of your LDAP server or LDAP directory. And they can actually vary depending what kind of implementation you use. But the bow or the all of them have to support the LDAP communication protocol. We can also look at the history, how it was developed. Because I have here this ISO OSI and X500 standard. Did anybody hear of the X500 standard? And then let me tell you a very quick information about the original development of LDAP. Originally, you had something like the X500 directory, and the access how it was accessed was where the ISO OSI protocol stack, and that's an alternative to the TCP/IP protocol stack. And ISO OSI, that was basically a protocol stack defined by a standardization committee. And the intention was that actually the communication protocols in the global network would adhere to the ISO OSI protocol standard with the 7 layers. But then it was basically the TCP/IP became a de facto standard, and the ISO OSI protocol standard basically lost out. The only thing which was successful in the ISO OSI standard was the X500 directory, and that was the directory service, especially with mapping names and meta information towards the appropriate address and additional profile information. TCP did not have anything equivalent. It did nothing existed. They had the domain name service, which basically gave only a mapping between name towards address and no additional information attributes and meta information. And therefore, the first step was to have something like the LDAP server, and you had here a client in the TCP world, so here TCP/IP world, and the important thing was with the LDAP server that it spoke the LDAP protocol here, and it spoke the ISO-OSI protocols here. And therefore, in that sense, the LDAP was something like a gateway just to come to have access to an X500 directory server. And then later on, it was decided that, it was pretty inconvenient always to map the TCP protocol or TCP messages into the appropriate ISO-OSI messages to access the thing. Then it was decided, do we really need this part of it here, or can't we just take the whole thing here, put the data management here, and also have the management facilities which you supported here in the directory service. And because before you just did a protocol mapping. And now you put a lot of these management facilities also into the LDAP server. And therefore, in that sense, then this part was basically then eliminated. And now the LDAP server, it's just a regular directory service within the TCP world. And that's something like how it developed over the in the history. And that's already mentioned. And it has here four different models. One is information model, which basically provides the way how the data are structured, the entries, the naming model to reference objects or entries in the LDAP server, the functional model, which provides information about the communication protocol and the operations, and then security model, that's more or less ways of authenticating, like how to, and also if you look at some LDAP servers, they also provide anonymous access that you can get a mapping of name towards the appropriate address information, but you might not be able to access certain meta information, or you might not be able to modify any entries or add new entries. Therefore, anonymous access is somewhat strongly restricted with respect to the use. We can look at the architecture as it is provided. Therefore, you have here the LDAP server. You have, again, a client-server behavior, like sending a request message and getting a reply message. You have here the application, and then you have local included an LDAP client. Usually, if you use a regular browser like Firefox or so on, the LDAP client is included in your web browser. And then you use just regular TCP, and then the LDAP server accesses the information. Data representation, it uses strings. And it's not binary, and it's also not, and it's, we can also say it's before XML times. I mean, LDAP exists longer than XML. And it also does not use more complex representations. I mean, here, other representations would be ASN 1. So here, not ASN 1. That was a data representation at that time when LDAP was developed, which was already available. And that's much more complex. And therefore they said, well, we just use strings. The first you have a binding, then with the IP address and port, and as far as I remember, 389, it's the standard port of it, then you can have either anonymous access or name and password, and then you can have multiple read-write seek. Seek is just to search for an entry, and then you can do an unbinding. If you do a search, then you have the option, as we will see later, to restrict it to a certain part of the LDAP structure. Therefore, in that case, to make the response time much faster. And for example, if you search for something like in the computer science department, you don't have to search for the complete database of the technical university. You can say, well, take the tree, though, the subtree of the computer science department. And in that sense, you have a number of parameters to configure your search and get a better response time. Let's look at the information model. The basic unit, is an entry. Therefore, here, that's the basic unit, and every basic unit has a distinguished name. And that's used for identification. And we have something like an absolute distinguished name and a relative distinguished name. And it has the same semantics as if you look, compare that with file systems, where you say the absolute file name or the relative file name, and where you have the path associated with it. Relative means you're in some area, and then from that area you can have the path towards the object. And the same thing is here. You are at some entry, and then you can, with relative, take the path towards the final entry. Absolute means you basically start from the root. The syntax, what you have available, and certainly I didn't mention yet, you have these attributes, and these attributes have multiple values. The syntax, or let's say we could even say the types. These attribute types which are supported. It can be binary information. It can be case exact string. And in that case is significant for comparison during search. Case ignore string, that's upper and lowercase, doesn't play any role. You can have telephone number as a type. And that would mean blanks, colons, and possibly also certainly colons or also dashes might have a specific meaning. I mean, depending how telephone numbers are written. You have the distinguished name, you have the time for year, month, day, and then you have something like a postal address, and then you can have multiple lines for the postal address. And the separation occurs via the dollar sign. Therefore, the whole thing is just a string, and then in between you have here your dollar signs, and that provide information that a new line has to be generated. And if you look at some examples, There's the attribute common name, and the syntax, it has the attribute type, and then the name of the entry, and here it can be like the username. Or surname can be here as an example, Smith. Or telephone number, that's an example. Or organizational unit name. Organization is here, in one is the computer science department or informatic, and here TUM. Then owner, that's a distinguished name, and here you already see the distinguished name consists of several attributes. So here consists of several attributes. And it's different what you see from other things where you have a special name on it. Here, the distinguished name is generated out of some attributes. And here, the picture of it, of the photo of John Smith, can be is just a binary. The possibilities also that you can have constraints to attributes associated it. For example, here constraints that you can add 10K at maximum. That this photo can have at most 10K of size. And you could also attach constraints towards this attributes. The other thing is, here these are single attributes. You can now combine attributes to schemas and say, well, they belong together. Like common name and surname, that's a very simple thing to put it together, like internet organization person. That would be a schema which consists of multiple attributes. And you can combine a number of attributes towards one schema, and then therefore we can say this is here basically just a list of attributes. The thing here, we can also look at the naming model in the LDAP environment. And one of the things is you have something like what they call a directory information tree. And an entry in the LDAP server is basically an entry in the directory information tree. The important aspect here is that this directory root, that's conceptual. And it does not really exist. And therefore, if you compare it with in Linux, like a file system, there the root exists. And you can use the root as starting point to navigate towards the along the path. Here you can say this part of the LDAP directory information tree is on LDAP server 1. This here is on LDAP server 2. Therefore, in that sense, it's somewhat similar as what you have in the web. In the web, you don't really have a root of all the HTML pages. You have something like a conceptual root, namely the starting point with respect to your URL. But the root as a an entity does not really exist in the same way as it is here. You have also again here this distinguished name, absolute and relative. This is RDN and DN. And the interesting thing is, if you look at names, let's look at a path name in the operating system like Linux. That's a path name from root to node. Basically, you navigate from the root to the node. And if you look at LDAP, it's actually just the reverse. That's the path name, so here path name from node and now to conceptual root. And here, if you look at it, you can basically have, if you look at John Smith, you can have a path name, then that's the distinguished name, take the attribute here, take the attribute here for organization, and take here the C for the country. Therefore, in that sense, this one is part of the root, of the distinguished name, this one, this one. And it does not mean that every attribute belongs to it. It's only a certain attribute from each node. Here the attribute CN, here the attribute O, here the attribute C. And that's now here the distinguished name, and that's also the path name. But you develop it in that direction. And instead of Linux, where you develop it from top down, here you develop it from bottom up. You have the possibility of aliases, and when you navigate here, you could say here this entry is an alias for that, and also you have something like references. And what we would call these referral entries. And these referral entries, they refer to an entry at another LDAP server. And it uses the URI structure. And the URI structure would be then something like here, LDAP. Here instead of HTTP, you use LDAP. Then you use here the host name to get to the appropriate LDAP server, and then possibly also the port, and then you use something like here, CN, John, and then here, Smith. Whoops. And also the, OU organizational unit, and so on. And to basically come to the and at the end you would say, well, you want to do that in the US, and therefore what you provide here is here the distinguished name on as parameters, and here you use basically the same thing as you know that from URIs, these universal resource identifiers. And URL is the one which you use in the web environment. And instead of LDAP, you use an HTTP. You can use also for file access. You have file for local access to access a certain file. Therefore, in that sense, it adheres also to the universal resource identifiers. But here you provide, like here, you could also have this here as a distinguished name here at the end. And that's just a blank space. I think that's all with respect, with respect to the naming model, what is supported by LDAP. And the next thing is the functional model. And the functional model, as I said, provides you information about the messages as well as the operations supported by it. The messages I leave now off, how they are structured. And what we can say, we have three categories with respect to LDAP operations. One is something like let me do it here. That's here. These first three, that's the update category. Then the second category would be query, to interact with and search for certain things. And the last one would be something like authentication. And that's part of like bind, unbind, and it also provides information how to log in to an LDAP server, provide name and password and things like that. So here, name, password. So here, login. That's the important part of it. And also bind and unbind. Access rights play a role in the sense of what are you allowed? Are you only have read access or have you also write access? The functions update, create, delete, update. That means to modify the distinguished name. And modifying the distinguished name means also move within the directory information tree. And therefore, in that sense, because if you change certain attributes, you might move it in the directory information tree. The search, we can look at it how what kind of possibilities you have. And it provides you the option to search either the whole directory information tree or some portion. And also you can provide what information you want to be returned to the requesting process. And for example, here, you try to access just an attribute. The attribute here, the distinguished name, and then the attribute associated with this node. Or you can say find all children in that sense which belong here to the computer science department. And therefore, in that sense, the entry can be just an attribute value, or it can be a number of information about entries. And the user may also have the possibility to constrain here I have a constraints with respect to the search. The constraints are on three areas. The one is the definition of the starting point. You can basically start at a certain node in the directory information tree. And you have a second option, how deep we want to search. How deep means here I only want to search the object, the base object. That means the starting point. And that would be something like this here, to take the postal address from that person, or a single level. In that case, you search the children, the base object not, or the whole subtree. That means the starting object, and then all children recursively underneath. And then you can also limit the search in a way that you say, well, referral entries, I don't want to follow. Aliases, I don't want to follow. Therefore, in that sense, you can restrict it, for example, to your local LDAP server or to the starting LDAP server. And then you can have something like a combination of attributes. You provide here, that's an and, and here that's a not. And the interesting thing is here that in some way it looks pretty similar like a Lisp representation. And therefore here that's the you search for something, a common name. It has to have the starting SCHMI and then possibly some other continuation. And again, the person is not supposed to be in the language code DE associated with. And can be India or South America or whatever. The other possibilities is what you want to return. It can be return all attributes. It can be returned the attribute values, or it can be also the values plus the attribute types. Therefore, in that sense, you can somewhat play around how much you want to have returned. A simple code example is the following. That's now C code. That was the original start, how LDAP was used, basically using C functionality. Here, that's your search filter. It's CN. Then here you have the connection to it. And if you can't connect to it, you basically exit. You authenticate it as nobody. That's basically an anonymous connection. Usually what is often required, that a password is not null. That very often the requirement is that you have something like an email address, your email address or something attached as password. Therefore, anything is accepted, and usually they don't really confirm if that is a valid email address. They basically try to see if it has the structure of a valid email address, but otherwise it's not really verified if it's a valid address. Then you bind it. So here you connect it, then you bind it, and then you search. And search means here that's a search base. That's basically is the start. So here that's the base object. Then the scope. That means here search subtree. Then search filter, that's what you provide to search for. Then you have here the things you want to see all all attributes, also all entry attributes, also here all entry attributes you want to see, not just specific ones. And here the this here means, therefore I didn't see the zero before, here means return attribute, also here attribute values and types. If it's binary, if it's CIS or CES and so on. That's the attribute types what I mentioned before. And now you can actually make multiple searches in one session. And that's the way how you interact basically with the with LDAP server. And at the end you just make your unbind again. And in Java it's you have a very similar interaction way compared with C. It's just you have the Java object and then trying to execute the Java methods. The one thing what I wanted to mention is this this LDIF exchange format. Now it's not so much so often used anymore, this LDAP data interchange format. At the beginning, it was a way of exchanging like address book information. You have had, for example, in Outlook, and you wanted to import it into like Thunderbird or things like that, where you had the possibility and said, well, my contact information, I want to reuse. And this here, this LDAP or LDIF exchange format could be used as a way to exchange contact or resource information between multiple systems. Therefore, what they had here is they had the attribute and then they had here the values. Like the distinguished name was this here. The CN common name was here this value, object class, and so on. And here the more or less the whole attribute information and the types here and the attribute names and then the attribute values. And that was basically an exchange format. And if you go into like Thunderbird and you can say, well, export your contact library or the address book, then you generate a huge LDIF data file where you can look at it, how it actually looks and what information is there in your LDAP, in your contact information. That does not mean that your Thunderbird maintains the contact information internally as a directory information tree. That does not mean. It basically just generates the LDAP exchange format. And that was part also of the standardization of LDAP, to have something like an exchange format. The last thing in with respect to client-server, I wanted to look at fault-tolerant services. And the point is here that fault-tolerant services means that you have multiple copies of your service. For example, multiple servers running. And if one server fails, another server might take over the duty of the failed server, and then for clients, the service still is available. It might be that somewhat the performance is reduced. But otherwise, you don't really have an interruption of your service. And that's something what fault-tolerant services might provide. You can have redundancy with respect to service, where it's more often, but you could also have client copies multiple times. Usually, it's most of it, you provide server groups to have the multiple servers providing the service. You have here two types, modular redundancy and primary standby. Modular redundancy, that's something like here you have the server group consisting of three servers. And if the client sends a request, basically the request is sent to all of these servers. You have the execution. The answer is, the response is sent back. And now the voting unit looks at the results and then compares the results. And then it takes, for example, here that returns, I just take down numbers. Here this one returns 2, 2, and this one returns 1. Then basically it votes and says, well, I assume 2 is correct. And then it would return 2 as a result of the request. This type of server group was used, for example, well, it might, that's actually before your birth time, in the moon landing vehicle, and when they had the lunar vehicle, when they started to land on the moon, they basically had three computers as active in a server group, and then they were computing like the speed, distance, how they should reduce the speed to provide then the landing, and then had the voting unit, and then basically could decide what would be the appropriate value in landing on the moon. What does this server group tolerate? It tolerates something like what you often call, yeah, not often, what do you call hardware errors, or something like, yeah, heating errors, or things like that, or hardware failures. Because the situation is, if you just have the same software running here, here, and here, and you have a software error in it, everyone produces the same software error. And therefore, in that sense, the same result is reduced by every server, and then you take the wrong results. Well, what could you do to avoid that? I mean, here we talk toleration of hardware errors. And that was the primary focus on the on the moon landing vehicle. And you have to think, I don't know, when was the moon landing? End of the 60s. I mean, there the computer hardware was not comparable what you have today, on be it smartphone or something else. I mean, it was very different. And they focused a lot on the hardware problems. They started to talk about something like N-version programming. And the point was here that, for example, you have three versions of your software implementations. The way how they arranged it, they had something like the requirements or the preliminary design of the problem and the concept of the solution, and then they had teams to do the implementation, and these teams were basically completely isolated. They were not allowed to talk to each other, and they had no contact with each other, just to avoid similar errors in programming. And the idea was that they would basically, if they make an error, they would make the errors independently, and therefore the probability would be rather low that they would make the same error. And therefore they might have here an error for certain things, here they might be correct, here might be correct, and the assumption was that the software errors in programming would be independent, and therefore no team would make the same error. And that was the intention of N-version programming. The difficulty is that if you think of it and say, well, we want to do a Windows implementation of your operating system, and then you have three teams. And you already know how large these operating systems teams are in implementation. Therefore, the cost is actually immense. And the point was, where they looked at it was mostly in very critical things, especially the moon landing things. Also at the initially they didn't have that in the original moon landing, and when there was the first moon landing, basically all three machines failed and provided complete wrong answers. And because you have to think of it like this one provides three, this two, this one. What does the voting unit do? It can't really decide, because now it does not have any majority. And that's also the reason why you have an uneven number of replication, because that makes it easy to provide a majority, if you have a majority. If you have an even number, you could end up with four, two vote this, two vote that. You have a 50% chance. And therefore, you always take an uneven number. But as far as I remember, with the original, the first moon landing, the machines provided not really common results anymore for landing, and then they basically landed the lunar vehicle by joystick and estimate looking out of the window, as you had it with at that time also with planes. Good, that's one modular redundancy. And the other things, what you find more often, because it's somewhat easier to handle, is something you could have also multiple clients, multiple servers. But what you have is, you have something like a primary. And you would say, this one is the primary, and this one is the primary. The point is here that the request is sent to the group. And so here, request sent to group. And not S1. Therefore, in that sense, you need something like a group management. And for the client, it does not really know who is actually the current primary. It sends it to the group. And when you get the request, the request is basically executed here. And it's the request is propagated. I have it here as a single line. You could also provide it in a way that you say, well, it looks like this here, that this is S1, sorry, this is S2, this is S3, and you had this here, you sent this here and this here. I mean, it's it does not mean that you put it in a row. You can also put it. The important thing is here that you can propagate it, the information to the next, to all the standbys. These are standbys. And active or hot standby is basically they are up and running. And therefore they are able to immediately take over when this one fails, because they are up to date and they can immediately continue even the current open request. Cold standby means that these here have the servers or the state, but open requests and so on are not really handled. And that would mean, for example, if you have a telephone call and you get the interruption, your telephone call is interrupted and you have to redial again to communicate with your partner again because of the switching system failed. And sometimes it's necessary that these cold standbys have to be restarted by a system administrator. They have they write the current state in a persistent storage, and then it's just read out of the persistent storage. If we have here a hot standby, it also means if this here, this one does the execution, if this one is finished, it tells the standbys that it performed the request. Therefore, they know the request is not open anymore. And if it was a write operation or a modification, it would also provide the information what's the current state. Therefore, in that sense, you need also the state transfer to be communicated here to these standbys. If it's just a read, you don't need a state transfer because nothing changed. The other thing is, what happens if something fails? Well, you can have something like a linear order, as I have it here. If this one fails, well, this one takes over because it's in a linear order. If we have it in a way like here, then we would have something like a selection process. And there exists, for example, possibilities like in computer networks with token rings and things like that, where you can select a new primary. And very often, every server which is ready to take over the role as a primary might send ready for a primary, and they would distribute it to all partners it knows. And then the selection process would be that this host, which has the lowest IP address and which is ready for taking over the role as a primary, becomes the winner. And this is a well-defined process. Because for everyone, if they send each other the ready to take over, this one knows the IP address of the sender. This one knows its own IP address. Therefore, you always have a unique winner in the whole thing. And in that case, it makes it a very simple selection process. And that's you find very often that everyone who is ready sends out a ready message. And then adds its IP address, and then you use the IP address as a selection attribute. Good. These are now two ways of doing the of handling the fault tolerant services. The main problem with this here is, I mentioned that the goal is to interact with the server group. And there are some implementations where actually the client interacts directly with the server, that it knows what server is actually the primary. And that's something which might cause problems. Because especially in the situation if you say these ones are not standbys, like if you have a client 1 and then you have a client C2 and they are not in a group, and you have a server 1, server 2, server 3, and they are actually a group, and here they belong to each other, and you say now this one is the primary, and the point is here that you might have a redundancy in a way. What you find often that you say I want to have this group on one hand for fault-tolerant purposes, and on the other hand, I want to have this group for performance issues. And if you use it for performance issues, let's say then it's rather costly if you say, well, these twos are just standbys and wait just for failures of this one. Therefore, what you usually have is, okay, you use also these ones to improve performance. You might have now a situation, this one contacts here this server, and this contacts this one, and interacts with this one. The point is now, what do you use a primary for? The primary you use for to have consistent replicated data. And the primary, what you use here for is something like to linearize write operations, that usually then this write request would be propagated to that one. This one would linearize it, and then you would have the sequentialization of your write messages. If they can't contact each other, then this one might interact, and now the states might diverge. And then you might run off into a problem. And therefore, in that sense here, you have a primary, but this primary is not always up to date with respect to write operations. And therefore, in that sense, combining redundancy for fault-tolerant purposes and for performance issues is you have to be very careful, because it can end up in a certain inconsistency situations, and that they are triggered because they work in parallel with it. And therefore, if you have something like performance and fault-tolerant redundancy, if you want to support both, if you want to have a new primary, then possibly you need some kind of a specialized selection process where you also have a state exchange between the partners, and to run into a consistent change. It's a lot more complicated as in the situation of a hot or cold standby. But usually the intention is that this one would only be allowed to contact this, and this one would not be the supposedly allowed. But you never know. Good. The next is RPCs, and we will look at the interaction between the components and the issues we want to look at. What is RPC? What is RMI? What are the specific characteristics? We talk about the problems with respect to the usage. One problem I can mention are, how do you handle pointers to data structures? Then what is a client and server stub? And what is an RPC generator? And you have something similar also in RMI. And also the problem is how the partners find each other. And that's certainly something like a use for name or directory services. And then you can do fixed binding, dynamic binding to connect client and servers. If we look at RPC, RPC stands here for Remote Procedure Call. And if you look at a local procedure call, you have a caller and a procedure you call. And what do you use the procedures for? It's for structuring program code. So here, for structuring program code. And what you have is here, you have something like when you do a request, you have a transfer of data and a transfer of control. So here, transfer of data and control. And then you get the procedure results back. And in that sense, if you look at it, you have something like a single-threaded execution. And RPC, that was something what the designer said, well, we have that in a local environment. We also want to have that in a remote environment. And now you see already the distinction. You have something like an interface between remote systems. You try to have here the same thing is that you have here a transfer of control and data, and here a transfer back. But here that's a process, and that's a process. And that also means that you have something like different address spaces. As it means here you have two processes, here a process and there a process. And that provides some specific behavior. The definition goes back already for quite some time, 82, when they tried to come up. And the important things were in the definition, it's a synchronous flow of control and data. Therefore, in that sense, it's this remote invocation sending the request and waiting for the result. And that's what I mean here. The client is blocked until it receives the answer from the called procedure. Okay, you might have a timeout, because otherwise, if the server is not available or the serving object, then you wait forever. Another part is that it looks like a procedure call. And that was the most important part, to invoke the function of a remote process using a procedure call. Because before, what happened, the client had to something like build a message, either an application message like mail message or a FTP message, depending on the protocol, the application protocol, what you had. You built a message and on the client side. And on the server side, you built a message for the answer. And that was the important stuff of it. RPC calls look the same independent if it's a local procedure call or remote procedure call. As I mean, we can say, look the same for local and remote procedure calls. And it would mean that you actually, when you have a, if you want to invoke a remote procedure, you would write it in a way that you say, well, I write here procedure, the procedure name, and then our parameter argument 1, argument 2, and so on. And if it returns like a string or an identifier, you might assign it to a variable. And that's the way how it's invoked, a remote procedure. And it's in the same way, if you look at RMI, the remote method invocation, you just make a method call. You write the object name and then write the method you want to invoke. The other important aspect is they run in different aspect spaces. And that has a major impact. How do you handle pointers for parameter passing? If you have a local procedure call, very often you provide something like a value, like an integer value or a string, but very often you also provide just parameters. And they parameters... pointers. And these pointers point to somewhere on your stack or on your heap. And just in your local memory, in your local memory in your address space. Well, that you can't do. Because the pointers in one address space are invalid in the other one. We need a different approach. Small channel communication, reduced bandwidth, and therefore in that sense, the majority, so here majority of calls has less than 200 bytes. So here has less than 200 bytes. And that makes also the decision, well, do you want to use TCP for a remote procedure call? For that, you have a large overhead on establishing a connection, open it up, make the call, and then and returning the results and closing it. Wouldn't it be more appropriate to use UDP? Because there you don't have the overhead of establishing a connection. And that's one of the aspects which are relevant for the RPC. And I think we can stop here and then go into RPC properties next week. And let's stop here. And then we can...